as far as I can see, we'll be able to. We're not going to finish the chapter of Sloki. We can finish the second one. Review the first one, finish the second one. And later today, cover the third one. We'll see. Maybe you can do a quick gloss of the final one. So, main points for the... What's the... Aham Eva Asam Eva Greg? Nan Yad Yad Sarasat Param? Pashadaham Yad Etachcha Yovishish Yeta Sosmyaham. Krishna is instructing Brahma, Aham, it is I, the personality of God who existed before creation. I alone exist during the cosmic manifestation. Paschadaham yadetachcha, and that which you, and after annihilation, what remains will also be Aham. What are some of the points that we discussed, or that Srila Prabhupada presented, and we tried to review?
Maharaj, impersonalness, they misinterpret this verse to mean that it is Brahman is the supreme. That we are the I, which is referring to as the impersonal Brahman. So that's the way they interpret. And Srila Prabhupada spends a lot of time in the purport to defeat that presupposition. So one of the points which we discussed was that from Srila Prabhupada quotes Katha Upanishad was to establish that this I, there is a difference between predominated I and predominator I. So one is the predominator and other is the predominator. So Krishna is the predominator and the living entities are the predominator. So that was one point.
Let's see if we can get others to now jump on board. So the starting point was the misconception which Vaishnavas don't deny a feature of oneness, but while there is that feature of oneness, one has to balance it for the whole picture and understand simultaneous differences. So there's qualitative difference, but there's four differences we identified. One is that one is predominator I, and the other is predominated I. What's another one of the four that were listed here? One is what?
One is fallible, subject to limitations.
That's another point. But the mere fact that they are different personalities. Brahma is not Krishna. Krishna is not Brahma. Then another difference. Yeah, and what is that?
Before creation there was only Krishna.
Yeah.
After the annihilation there is only Krishna.
Yeah.
During the creation, during the cosmic manifestation there is Krishna and Brahma.
And Brahma and the varieties of other people and things. So Krishna is existing eternally and the others are coming into being and going out of being during the phases of creation. So that some difference in that respect. And then the fourth one. Go ahead. Kshara and Akshara.
Ontological difference. one is the source of various dimensions.
Yeah. And that fourth one becomes very important in the whole next of the chapter Sloki. These ontological differences is describing a little bit, maybe even defining the nature of the absolute truth, and in comparison, the nature of relative truths. Relative truths also exist, but they exist in relation to and dependent for their existence upon the absolute truth. That something is dependent for its existence upon another thing, another entity, doesn't mean it's false. It means it's a relative truth. One is the absolute truth, and by definition, absolute means the source of everything. So now, going back, we've identified some differences. So this is Lord Chaitanya's simultaneous oneness and difference philosophy, with the verse emphasizing the oneness feature, but when you examine more closely, the differences are also there. So we don't endorse Kevala Advaita philosophy. We endorse Abheda, but Veda simultaneously. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur presents something very nice in his, because one of the essential teachings in Dasamula of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as rendered by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one of the 10 essential teachings is Achintabheda Tattva. And in discussing this in very simple question-answer format, Bhaktivinoda did this with village people to teach them Achintabheda Tattva, to teach them Lord Chaitanya's teachings. He composed songs, and they would have them sing the songs. And then they'd have little questions, answers. So the questions would be connected to the song. So then when they went back and sang the song, they would have some idea of the meaning of the song. Something like what you're doing with these pictures to go along with the bhajans. So the picture will tell them something, so when they hear the bhajan, they'll have a mental picture, an image in their mind to connect to the song. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur did through question-answer method. So in describing the nature of the relation between God and His energies, which is an essential part of Bhagavad philosophy and therefore an essential part of Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, he raises the question, well, you're describing about these different energies, and it's all very clear. Inferior energy and superior energy, and the Lord is the source of both of those energies, and so forth and so on. There's detailed things. So, the question is then raised, why do you call this inconceivable? Because you're explaining it, and it's quite conceivable. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur's answer is, we say inconceivable because when the energies start mixing, it's so intricate and delicate and subtle that we can't perceive it. We can describe it. This energy mixes with that energy and produces an appearance of another energy. But it's when it's happening, it's part of it's is part of the next verse, it's part of Maya, that we can't discern the connection because of how they work together. It's not moral, it's not just difficult, complex, it's inconceivable. Yes, that was his answer. To say simultaneous, one and different, is not so inconceivable. But the mind, another explanation that I've heard, it wasn't from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but the mind is a binary function like computers. It's either a one or a zero. And it's not, can't be both one and a zero at the same time. It's got to be one or the other. So it's either one with or different from, but how do you hold both the one and the zero in your mind at the same time? It's a binary instrument. You can't. But it is simultaneous, and therefore it's inconceivable. And therefore access is not through intellectual process. Process. That's what the intellect does. Material intelligence doesn't have those properties. It has these properties. That's what, by material intelligence, you cannot discern the nature of Krishna and how his energies are working. It remains inconceivable. It's impenetrable by that methodology. Before you even start, mogasya, moga karma, moga jnana, vichetasa. You're defeated. When I was traveling once, I saw a t-shirt. If you can't win, don't play. Moga jnana. Defeated. Play a game that you know before you even start, you're going to lose. So then they'll say, well, intelligence for intelligence sake, knowledge for knowledge sake. Silly. Childish. Especially in the realm of understanding. So the absolute truth is discernible by descending process, and the descending mercy is connected to by the process of devotion. And not otherwise. So, inconceivable oneness and difference. So the verse is emphasizing the oneness, and the next verse is indicating how the Lord moves matter and makes the movement of that matter appear as if it's acting independently, and that appearance of things, that's his illusory energy. Anyway, back to this one. The next point in sequence that's presented is about the nature of the absolute truth once again. So that Krishna, that aham, is the absolute truth. And the absolute truth is personality, aham. And then the implication of that is that there's also an abode, a realm of the absolute. Just as when we say king, it means, it implies kingdom. With variegatedness. Kingdoms have variegatedness. Personalities have personality and qualities and characteristics and friends and things they like and things they do. And that's the, it's implied, it's implicit. Aham. And impersonalists know that. Therefore, they want to put aham through a blender, come out with homogenized no personality. What else did we discuss? Several things. Yeah.
One point we discussed was that Lord Krishna is Sarvasat Param. He is the cause of all causes. There may be many causes and effects. That Brahman may be the cause of immediate cause of material creation. But Lord Krishna is even the cause of Brahman. He is Brahman Pratishtha. He traces back the cause of all causes.
Yeah. Sarasat Param. Nanyad Yat. Sarasat Param. Very good. Yeah.
In this relation, we also discussed the example of the potter making the pots.
From Chaitanya Charitamrita. And what did we discuss about that?
That although the pot is made up of earth, and it is made by using the potter's tools, but behind that is a potter who is actually making it.
And therefore?
So therefore, although it may appear that living beings are coming from Prakriti, material nature, but behind the workings of Prakriti is the Supreme Lord Krishna. Who is, earth is like Mahatattva, and the tools is the Prakriti, and earth is a Mahatattva, behind that is Purusha.
Yeah. So in short, one can analyze. This is another thing that intellects do. The intellect is supposed to analyze things according to cause and effect. And since there may be very reasonably accurate descriptions of cause and effect, like in the studies of technology, cause and effect. It's sutra work. Really, it's just, you know, like, you know, making a piece of art or musical instrument or making a pot or something. It's this cause produces that effect, and you understand how this cause produces that effect, and then you reproduce in different ways. It's the cause and the effect. Just reproduce something that's happening within nature. We're going to hear more about scientists later today. But that's incomplete picture of things. Just that limited cause and effect. So what's the cause of that cause? That's the effect of another cause, which is the effect of another cause, which is the effect of another cause, which, so what's, where does it all come from? That's Vedanta. So this first verse is defining the conclusion of Vedanta. Aham. Anything else?
We were discussing that in relation to Lord Brahma's question, what are the forms of the Lord in the matter of transcendence, and what are the forms of the Lord in transcendence and in matter? We were discussing that although Lord Krishna, he exists in the spiritual world, and he also comes here as Mahavishnu, still both of each other are Akshara. They are not Akshara features. We also discussed this regard, and the energies of the Lord, they are sharing oneness.
Yeah. Because the Lord does appear in this material world through his energies. This is also Krishna. The material energy is, in one sense, a manifestation of Krishna in terms of appearing represented by his various energies.
you were mentioning about the last two lines, the significance of last two lines, is that even in impersonal, when we see impersonal energy or when we are trying to study, our focus should be on realizing the personality of Supreme Lord. Because this is what it means, that we have to see the Supreme Lord's presence in us.
The scratching. Can anybody recall that Narasta Kuhakam, that reference, or the statement that Prabhupada was making about that the Supreme Lord is materially impersonal? How did that fit into this discussion? Either one of those? No.
The point that in the material world the Lord is impersonal. It was explained that the king.
In the material world the Lord is impersonal. Better explain that one.
The king is there in his various departments in the government offices. Mm. His presence is felt as impersonal. His presence is felt in terms of rules and regulations, and he's not personally present over there. But whereas in his home we find his. We'll find his personal features. Similarly, in Golok, Vrindavan, or in Vaikuntha planet, we'll find the Lord personally, but here he is existing through his energies.
And therefore, materially impersonal, in the sense that his presence is not readily detected. His personal presence is not readily detected, although his personal presence is there, otherwise that energy would not even be there. It would be unmanifest. The fact that the energy is there indicates his presence, but not readily appreciable, therefore materially impersonal. And Nirasta Kuhakam, can somebody remember that one? Yeah?
You were saying that the Lord is conspicuous by his absence from illusion.
From illusion, exactly. There we don't find illusion in him. Okay. We all the pot in the sky within the pot. That discussion. Yeah.
Explaining that within the pot there is the sky and the sky exists.
I'd like to qualify. I was explaining that impersonalists use this example. Go ahead.
To explain the oneness, to emphasize only on the oneness part, that the sky exists within the pot and at the same time exists outside, so it's just the pot that is the obstruction. Once the pot is broken, then the sky merges with the totality. Mm. And so everything is one.
And so all I have to do is accept sannyas and call the world false, and now I'm Narayan. And so that's the impersonalist point of view. And what's the comment that Prabhupada makes about that point of view? Well, it's not a correct understanding, and why not? It's not elaborate. It doesn't require a lengthy explanation, but there's some explanation. I'll help you. He says this example is useful for persons in the neophyte position. For what? Towards what end? Yeah. All pervadingness of the Lord, and specifically all pervadingness of. He endorses the terminology cosmic consciousness, although what cosmic consciousness is pretty cosmic. But the universality or all-pervasiveness of the cosmic consciousness of the Supreme. That's to be acknowledged. But it doesn't mean that, therefore, we are that Supreme. That's a jump into illusion, a jump into non-cosmic anything. So, a false claim. So, the absolute truth has been defined, and the relationship of all things to relative truths emanating from that absolute truth have a relationship of oneness and yet simultaneously a relationship of difference. And this difference aspect is now going to be more strongly, very strongly emphasized, along with a furthering of the oneness feature. Pratertam yat pratiyeta na pratiyeta chatmani tad vidyat atmano mayam yata bhaso yata tamaha. O Brahma, whatever appears to be of any value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it as my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. Now I'm going to go directly to the translation found in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Page 18. Text 54. What appears to be truth without me is certainly my illusory energy. For nothing can exist without me. It is like a reflection of a real light in the shadows. For in light, there are neither shadows nor reflections. So, here's a... for you scientists, stretch your memories back to 8th grade science class where the teacher drew a picture, or in your science book, picture of the sun and then the earth and then the rotation of the moon around the sun and the shadows that are created from the sun. There's the umbra and penumbra. Remember that one? And you had to remember which is which, penumbra and umbra. So, this is one of those, this is a nice application of that. Something that's in the darker cone in the middle, that's the penumbra, correct? And then the other one is the umbra. So, what's in that penumbra region, that's darkness. And what's in the umbra region, that's light in darkness. And then what appears where there's direct light, that's direct light. So, in order to see, then there's a, so, in this terminology here, shadows, or reflection, so that there's abhasa is the word in Sanskrit from the text, and abhasa can mean either one of those two things. It can mean the light in the umbra region, or it can mean like a reflecting surface, let's say the moon, that is we're standing in the penumbra region, but there's a reflecting surface out there. And that reflecting surface reflects some light into the umbra region, into the penumbra region. So reflected light or shadow or partial light. And in photography they use these besides they have reflectors. And sometimes there's reflectors within the reflectors to make softer light. So it's not direct light. It's another kind of light. It's reflected light. It's still light, but it's reflected light. So it's another kind of light. And it makes a much, those people that know this art, it makes much better pictures because direct light is more harsh and stark and destroys clarity on the film. So, in light, there's neither penumbras nor umbras. In light means the direct light, nor reflections in the penumbra. There isn't any of that. There's, like, it, during the daytime, we can't see the moon. Or the illuminating power. It's there, but it's not so significant. Or the example that's also given here is finding the presence of the sun with the use of a flashlight. When you have used the word torch. That's silly. You don't require a torch to... Oh, there's the sun. It's self-luminous. So, there's a metaphor in this verse, and the metaphor is, it is like a reflection of real light in shadows. So that reflection of real light in shadows is like like the moon or the stars reflecting light at night. Or, say, at a distance, there's a mirror. And the mirror is reflecting light from some other place where you aren't because there's an object blocking, but the mirror reflects light into a dark place where that light source doesn't penetrate because there's some obstruction. So, light coming into a dark place. So Maya is like that. Reflection of real light in a shadow. And then it reverses it. For in the light, there are neither shadows nor reflections, meaning reflections of light. The light is so strong. The glowworm or firefly light is inconsequential. That's the metaphor, and the metaphor is to help understand the statement that slowness with the application part has to do with we're lazy and we're attached and we're deeply conditioned, and so it doesn't take place quickly, but it's the educator's responsibility to make sure at least the tools to work with are there. And then it gets down to sincerity. Now that I have the tools, and I need to understand the mission. The mission is remembering Krishna and terminating our material existence. Terminating our existence in the material realm and going to the spiritual realm. That's the mission. So depending upon one's sincerity, in proportion, like, you know, the previous verse, in proportion to one's faith, I'll apply. There's no harm in reviewing those essential tools and making sure that our essential tools are there and they're at our disposal. The other part is something that is a qualitative thing from our side, increasing our sincerity of purpose and our clarity of the mission. We're not accustomed to, in our material conditioning, to apply things for anything other than sense gratification. That's the program here. Get an education so you can get some money so you can have sense gratification. Just hearing Prabhupada on a cassette yesterday evening where Prabhupada was saying the whole program for material life is to improve one's standard of living. But what does that mean? I need money so that then I can get a car or a better car or two cars or, and then the living situation, I have to get a bigger apartment or a house or, and just upgrade my sense gratification. And that's the program. That's material life. Sense gratification. Grades of sense gratification according to one's capacity to acquire that. And we're very conditioned by that conception. And so we would be very eager to apply Krishna consciousness if it was designed to help us improve our sense gratification, but that's not its design. So we're at a little bit of a loss how to apply with the paradigm of sense gratification, you know, up to our ears and so up to our eyeballs and to the top of our head and spilling out over the top. So there's the sincerity factor. So some illusion is being cut away and some misconceptions are being dismantled and some tools for performing devotional service and faith conducive, doubt reducing procedures are essential. But that has to be combined with a real sincerity to achieve that purpose. I would say that this, the parikram that I did in Vrindavan, the most prominent thing that came out of that for me was greatly strengthening the sense of purpose of a life in Krishna consciousness. It's very simple to love Krishna. Very simple. And these things are necessary because otherwise one can just go and try to chant and tell descriptions of Krishna and these things are all, you have to have the right concepts and the fundamental basic things have to be there. Otherwise it's delusion. So this is a very important part. And if it's seen in the proper way, it's not dry, It's very important. It's very invigorating. It's sharpening my tools. It's like what Krishna is doing with Arjuna. He's giving him knowledge. With that knowledge, stand and fight. Armed with knowledge, stand and fight. And the boat of transcendental knowledge, you cross over the ocean of material existence, unlimited sinful reactions can be burned in the fire of transcendental knowledge. He's giving him all the glories, and it's not hype. It's very, transcendental knowledge is very glorious. But that has to be connected with the sincerity of purpose. Sincerity of purpose means applying. Taking the responsibility to move towards the goal with what our acharyas are providing us with for moving towards the goal. They're equipping us with this.
Of the shadow connects with the misconception that the Lord and the entity are formless.
Well, the description is very nice and simple. On this page that I, the same page that has the Ayurveda Sanskrit quote. The living entity is identified as reflection. Material energy is identified as darkness, and both reflection and darkness are subordinate realities or existences, subordinate or dependent upon the supreme reality of Krishna. So now, a materialist will not see the subordinate or dependent reality of things upon the supreme, and the impersonalist is also suffering because of not seeing that connection. But to philosophize that suffering out of existence, they philosophize the supreme out of existence. It's just word jugglery. But it's another, the statement that came at the beginning is this is another illusion. The first is obvious, and the second is perhaps less obvious, but insidious, illusion. So, we'll go back to the first one. The first one is, I'm suffering due to interacting with the material energies in such a way that I don't see their connection with the Supreme. I'm head over heels in sense gratification. So, and that's bringing suffering, because I'm not connecting with the Supreme. But not seeing the connection with the Supreme as the problem, not seeing the disconnection with the Supreme as the problem, I still want to enjoy, but I don't want to recognize the Supreme. But I can't enjoy through sense gratification, so I have to find my enjoyment in some other way. So then it starts to get dirty and intellectually tricky and dirty. and that is, the world is false, and all entities are false or formless. It's another illusion. It's not that things are false and entities are formless. But it's born of frustration, Prabhupada explains, that impersonalism is born out of frustration. I'm so frustrated with the material existence. There's no form, and there's no variety, and there's no existence. What does that leave? Neti neti. I'm the Supreme. It's another illusion. A reality that doesn't exist. Born out of frustration. So it's born out of frustration with the first illusion comes the more subtle illusion. They both have the same essential problem. The commonness of them is not seeing the connection of things with the Supreme. So I can not see it this way, or I can not see it that way. So the conception of formlessness is another illusion. And it's said in the purport that that's a covering potency of the Lord. Scientists, philosophers, and theologians. I can have a theological or philosophical idea. Everything is formless.
One feels dependent and helpless.
Mm.
Therefore, one calls out for and expresses one's dependence. And even in the advanced stage, one does that. But in the intermediate stage, we should keep on cultivating that.
Yeah.
And as we are bit by bit maturing, we are being also instructed that we should not be overly dependent in the sense of...
I explained that.
Why doubt is that? How does it... what does it reflect like? What does it manifest in practical activity?
I explained that. I was giving the example of tying shoes and should I step left foot first or right foot first. No, details are not over-dependent as I can't do anything. I'm catatonic. Or lethargic, or both. I can't take initiative to implement those things which I've understood, because I'm overly dependent. I have to be instructed, and then again instructed. Now, after moving my left foot, should I move my right foot? Overly dependent. So, but spiritually, I should be not independent. I should feel myself under the jurisdiction of the instructions. But now, under that jurisdiction of instructions, let me take some initiative according to the things that I've been instructed. Let me apply this, let me apply that. Not wait till somebody tells me to do it. Because the things had been told already, do it. So I don't need the prompt. I'm spirit soul, I'm not a machine. I'm not a robot. I have to have somebody key in the signals to now do this. I'm a soul, so I can act on the instructions. Take initiative. Taking initiative is, I'm not overly dependent. I'm spiritually dependent.
in the corner.
The example of?
Heat and fire. Heat and fire, okay.
Heat is dependent on fire.
That's right.
And the presence of heat implies the existence of fire.
Yeah.
But in the same way, the presence of fire also implies the heat, presence of heat.
That's right.
So, when we say that before creation there was only Krishna.
Okay.
And after analyzing there is only Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Then by this example there must be a living entity also presented.
Yeah. That was the question was asked yesterday about where is the scripture reference saying that the living entities during the unmanifest state that they're held within the body of the Supreme Lord. But they are. This is the overall understanding is, I described this yesterday, was the Shakti Parinamavad, the doctrine of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the doctrine of Vyasadeva is that the para and apara prakritis, they are energies of the Supreme Lord, and sometimes they're present in the form of creation, and sometimes they're held within the Supreme Lord in an unmanifest position. At least the material energy is the apara prakriti. The para prakriti is dormant as far as consciousness is concerned and held within the body of the Supreme Lord. But they, and each of the four disciplic successions have their particular way of describing, like Ramanujacharya's doctrine is Vishishta Advaita, that they're attributes of the Supreme Lord, and therefore creation is the attributes of the Supreme Lord being presented and then again withdrawn. So anyway, they exist, therefore, they exist as part of the Supreme, and therefore, before creation, I alone exist. So, the Pradhan before the creation, and Pradhan after annihilation, and Prakriti during cosmic manifestation. It's just different transformed states of the same existence. And the living entities moving around during creation, held within the body of the Supreme Lord during annihilation and before the creation. These energies, para and apara prakriti, they're also eternal. They have properties like the Supreme Lord. They're eternal. Their state of manifestation is not eternal. It's aprakat and prakat, manifest and not manifest. But the energies, they're eternal. They're real. Even in the unmanifest state, they're real. Just like stored electricity in a battery. It's real. And then you can make it manifest. That's also real. It's an energy. So does that?
Okay. If it is not too late, can I ask the question which I asked yesterday?
Now let's see if there's other questions. We'll hold that for the end. Yes.
By giving the elements of body, there is one element for unmanifested modes of nature. For this or other, it's related to Pradhan. Does that mean that
avyaktam, Mahabhutani ahankaro bhutir avyaktam evacha. Well, that's the conclusion of the verse is all these items, they're part of the field of activity, and the interaction of the components of the field of activity, meaning distinct from the knower of the field of activity, distinct from the soul, distinct from a conscious entity, and of course the supreme knower of the field, the jiva and paramatma. Distinct from jiva and paramatma, these are all components. So avyakta, that's the unmanifest state of those things which also have their counterpart in a manifest state. So that the big warehouse where everything is so jammed in together you can't even differentiate at all. And then you start unpacking the big warehouse and it has these different components. Unmanifest, manifest. Both are part of the field of activity, distinct from the soul and the supreme soul. Yeah. The unmanifest, in the purport, it just says the unmanifested of avyakta in the verse, the purport. Then there are false ego intelligence and the unmanifested stage of the three modes of nature. So the modes of nature, they're also unmanifest during annihilation and prior to creation. The modes of nature become manifest when time and Icha Shakti, Kala Shakti, when living entities are impregnated are by the glands of Mahavishnu. The living entities are there, so that's para prakriti, and kala shakti is there, but also icha shakti is there. That's the sanction of the Supreme Lord. Okay, now you can begin your activities. It's like a school teacher with their children in their classroom. Okay, it's recess, everyone can go and play. Bedlam breaks loose, the kids go running every all different directions. So that's the Icha Shakti. Okay, you can resume your fruitive activities. So then the modes of nature to have the variety of their fruitive activities. Prior to that, the modes are also, the three modes are not active. When it's fruitive activity time, modes of nature are required. Avyakta and Vyakta. Anything else? Yes.
The last layer of Maya is for the living entity.
He says it here too.
To consider himself the supreme. In overcoming these two coverings of the throwing potency and the covering potency, is it a progressive state that one has to go through?
Both are gradual. It's not like you polish off one and then you have the next mountain to climb. They're both gradual. There was something about this I was trying to recall. Yeah. The process of bhakti, unlike any other of the yoga processes, emphasizes from the very outset the dependence of the living entity upon the Supreme Person. Now, Prabhupada explains this in the final purport of chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita, that there must be some connectedness with the Supreme, or the other forms of yoga also, otherwise it's not yoga. Jnana without some dependence upon the Supreme is not jnana yoga, it's just jnana. Like what you're getting in the universities here. It's not jnana yoga. It's speculative knowledge. Packaged nicely, but it's speculative knowledge for enhancing one's fruitive activities. But from the very outset, that the emphasis is placed in bhakti yoga on depending upon the Supreme. And so, like in Bhagavad Gita, we're getting some knowledge from Krishna, and here we're getting knowledge from Krishna that can destroy the covering potency. But there's also action upon the throwing potency, and that is, it's like this question Akshay asked about, you know, the application part. Knowledge part is one thing. The application part has to do with our free will, or the misapplication of free will. That's where the throwing potency comes. Krishna doesn't throw us into the material world unless we desire to be in the material world. So fundamentally, this can also help us to become a proper, to decide to properly utilize our free will. I was saying in terms of sincerity. Sincerity of purpose, of achieving shelter at Krishna's lotus feet, of reawakening. I sincerely want to have my relationship with Krishna restored. And really, that should be core, like essence, very, very, very in the front of my considerations. Why I'm doing what I'm doing. Why I'm abandoning this misconception and taking the proper consent. And the impetus to apply is also in that. I want to restore my loving relation with Krishna. We're so habituated to non-transforming intellectual juggleries. But it's much easier for us to try to process this as information that we need to get A's in our exams on, rather than that which is going to transform my life to achieve that goal of reawakening my loving relation with Krishna. I don't get any dollars for that. I don't get any sense gratification for those dollars for that. In fact, it goes down. So that's, I'm more answering his question again than your question, but that's the problem. Is we're still in the material paradigm, trying to process spiritual wisdom. It doesn't connect with sense gratification, so I don't apply it because we don't. So this. Now back to your question, or responding to your question. This can help us become convinced to achieve the goal, which is awakening our loving relationship with Krishna. Because anything else, it's a loser. Moga, shamoga, karma, namoga, jnana, pachetasa, rakshasi, asarim, shaiva. I don't want to be in that position. I choose to not be in that position. then what other position is there? We'll have to have it defined. Clearly defined. I want to be in my loving relationship with Krishna. Then the throwing potency is no longer active. So they move in parallel fashion.
Yes.
What is the difference between Mayavada and
voidism?
What's the difference between Mayavada and voidism? Okay.
Is it that both negates the existence of personality?
Yeah, according to our acharyas, it's how the ribbon and bows are tied. It's the dressing only. It's cosmetic only. The difference is that Mayavad is actually voidism. What Shankaracharya did was he came after Buddha's teaching, which is stark voidism. He juggled some words, and it's voidism. But it sounds like something else. But it's voidism. What is that Brahman? Look at it closely. It's void. It's not Brahman as we know what Brahman is. It's not the effulgence of the Supreme Lord. What is that Brahman? It's non-existence. To illustrate, I wish I could recall this. I'll ask Sahotra Swami to do this for me. Once again, he did it as a mathematical equation. You know, this plus this equals this. Then he took the terminology of Buddha, this plus this equals this. And then he took the terminology of Shankaracharya, this plus this equals this. And to get those who were embracing Buddhism to accept his doctrine, he made it almost identical, but the words were different. But what he was doing was bringing back acceptance of the Vedas. That's the only step he took. It's void. It's covered voidism in the name of the Vedas. Accept the Vedas. Vedas don't teach voidism. They don't teach Mayavada doctrine. And that's what Lord Chaitanya said to Prakashananda Saraswati. This Shankaracharya, he's twisted the meanings so badly you can't even recognize the real thing anymore. He said it to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya also. I understand Vedanta Sutra very well, but the more you speak, it just clouds the meaning. Covers the meaning. It's voidism. What's the difference? Nomenclature. Cosmetic differences. It's not really a teaching of the Vedas. He tricked the Buddhists. He did exactly what he was told to do. Trick them. And Buddha did the same thing. He tricked them. Don't follow the Vedas, follow me. Now do what I say, which is what's in the Vedas. And then Shankara said, no, you should follow the Vedas. What do the Vedas say? They say what Buddha said. Oh, okay. Very good. Then in the strength of acceptance of the Vedas, then that was it was a good service. Because then Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Nimbarkacharya, Vishnu Swami, on the authority of the Vedas, they stated what the Vedas actually said. Paving the way for Lord Chaitanya to come and put it all together. The oneness and difference simultaneously, which is the real basis for devotional service. Devotional service is based upon, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, understanding the connectedness of all things with the Supreme. But it also requires understanding the variegatedness within that connectedness, the diversity within the unity. Therefore, it's substantiated to use microphones in Krishna service. Technology to use matter in service of the Supreme. And products of material intelligence in service of the Supreme, which is what we discussed yesterday morning. Without that, then the only way you can be a spiritual person is to be a tyagi. Disassociate yourself with all things and just be spiritual. Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam don't accept that. That's what Arjuna wanted to do. That's common. Misconception. Anyway. Covered Buddhism. Mayi Sarvani Karmani. Surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desire for profit. This is the purpose of Bhagavad Gita. 12:10. If you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, follow the regular principles of Bhakti Yoga, and this way develop a desire to attain to me. So your question is, are these two verses saying the same thing? That's what you're asking, essentially? Well, the previous verse to 12:10 is 12:9. Oh, wait a minute. 12:10, if you cannot practice the regulations of Bhakti Yoga. I'm sorry, I read the wrong. Okay. No. 12:9 is sadhana bhakti. 12:10, if you can't follow the regulations of sadhana bhakti, then try to work for me. So, in 3:30, one can also be a sadhana bhakta. Mayi Sarvani Karmani. You're trying to do that? With full knowledge of Krishna? Trying to do that? Without desire for profit? No claims for proprietorship? And free from lethargy? In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's a definition given right in the text of Krishna Mayi, because that's Mayi Sarvani Karmani. So, Krishna Mayi means seeing Krishna both within and without. So, Krishna conscious person sees Krishna in all things, and is maintaining or upholding thought of Krishna within. And with thought of Krishna within, it's implied, but there's also feelings in relation to Krishna, as one is thinking about Krishna within, contemplating Krishna within. So that's Krishna consciousness. So this is in the Karma Yoga chapter 330, but Karma Yoga, when it matures, is Bhakti Yoga. It's not just detaching oneself from work and giving some of the fruit of the work to Krishna. It's maintaining Krishna consciousness fully, and Karma Yoga is a subset of that, detachment from the work. So, in a narrow sense, yes, this is the same as 12.9, 12.10. In a broader sense, 12.9 and 10 are spanned by this one. This is describing the principle of Krishna consciousness, regardless of whether one is following the regular principles or just working for Krishna. It's the principle of Krishna consciousness. And the emphasis in the purport, at least, for 330, is Vigata Jvara. Very enthusiastically doing these things. Which means one isn't holding back just in case Krishna lets me down. I have to hedge my bets. I have to invest my energies, some with Krishna and some with, not with Krishna. Just in case Krishna, you know, spaces out or something and neglects me or something. You know, I don't do that with full faith in Krishna. This is with full faith in Krishna. So that's within and without. The essence of Krishna consciousness. And there, and that is the basis of enthusiasm. Spiritual, I mentioned this yesterday, spiritual conception is the basis of enthusiasm. So having such a spiritual conception, you don't have to hold back. Mayi sarvani karmani. And your consciousness absorbed. You don't have to be, well, I can keep my attention on Krishna, but I really have to, you know, be revved up in the material department also. Because Krishna's not going to look after me. Krishna's not going to supply me intelligence. I have to make sure. In the life of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, we observed his disappearance day the other day. On the 26th. And he was not... was sometimes said that he was illiterate. Illiterate means he could read and write, but he was not vastly learned in the Vedas. He was not a great reader of the Vedas. But he knew the conclusions of the Vedas. And he was decorated with opulences, like clairvoyance, like, you know, he was connected with the Supersoul in such a way he could understand immediately the heart and the mind of anyone who came before him. And even people that didn't come before him, persons who were on the other side of the country, or another part of Navadvipa, even as they were doing their mischief, he would announce, sit up in the middle of the night and call out loudly, that nonsense so-called sadhu, he's enjoying, at this moment he's enjoying with women in the dead of night, so-called renunciate. Would lie back down. And sure enough, so one can be decorated with qualities that are that are just directly gifts of Krishna as a result of fully depending upon Krishna and surrendering everything to Krishna. And that's a principle of Krishna consciousness. So just connecting back to your question, that's a principle of Krishna consciousness. Regardless, aside from the distinction of 12.9 and 12.10. It's a furtherance of the Karma Yoga principle. So 3.30 spans both. Whether one connects here or there depends on one's consciousness, or one's faith, or one's maturity on a spiritual path. Okay, so now your question. Why don't you just announce the question again?
Well, in the last visit you were saying that we are all complacent. We had some discussion amongst ourselves about how we were complacent.
How it manifests itself and what to do about it.
Yes, Maharaj. And you must have definitely seen some... You must have definitely seen some symptoms of that.
So, what's the punchline? What do you want to hear?
Actually, how will we know that as we are advancing that we are overcoming this complacency and. It sometimes helps to see the symptoms also, to understand that now I am again falling back into the same loop.
Well, several things. One thing is. A very simple, universal litmus test is your chanting. Just chanting Hare Krishna mantra. And with what degree of intensity or laxity one is taking that activity up. Very simple. And it doesn't take a greatly astute person to see the difference between laxity and intensity of effort. And they have a different result or manifestation. It definitely has bearing on the practical activities that we do also. And what that bearing is that where there's intensity, then I carry Krishna consciousness with me and an enthusiasm into my other activities of remembering Krishna and performing activities for Krishna very nicely and improving and maintaining the Krishna conscious humility as I conduct those activities. And we discussed this Krishna conscious humility is a feeling that I must always improve, because complacency is I'm okay, you're okay, everything's okay, we're going along fine, what's the matter, take it easy. It's complacency. Complacency doesn't mean gross violations or something. Complacency means some laxity of effort and laxity of submission and laxity of attentiveness in all things. And another point I already made, and that is yesterday, that along the same lines, with humility and also enthusiasm, carrying a spiritual conception. The basis of both, in their real sense, is carrying a spiritual conception, and same with this matter of complacency or what might be its alternative, taking initiative with a spiritual conception. The example that Prabhupada gave is when you're in the middle of a river, you're either moving upstream or downstream. But just treading water, you're downstream. So, applying that example, complacency in the middle of a very materialistic environment, you're going downstream. It may not be so noticeable, but downstream. So therefore, to the antidote for that poison is striving to go upstream. Striving. Or from the Brahma Samhita verse yesterday, perseverance in practice. So where that's absent, then there's a... That's what complacency is. And just say a perceptible manifestation of that is what I was noticing was just a kind of comfortable, relaxed mood. And and repeating words that are the right words with no substance, with no life to them. Repeating in a kind of robotic way. A parrot-like way, with no real life to them. But when there's life, when one is applying and one is striving, and impacts differently, there's life. It transforms. It's moving. I would say that by now, those of you, especially those of you that have been here for some time, should understand, as I've commented previously, the very nature of this kind of climate and, you know, the whole setting that you're in is conducive for take it easy, relax, enjoy life. It's the mode. It's. I was comparing it to Puerto Rico, and that's the mode. And it's really easy. It's, you have to, if you're not making a conscious effort otherwise, what will happen is that mode will grab a hold of you and control you. just the nature of the modes in this place. It's net, and so I'm saying, take that as a given. So as a given, if we can agree with that platform as an axiom for Singapore, then unless you're striving very vigorously and actively to go beyond your present position of Krishna consciousness, that mode will grab hold and prevail. And if it grabs a hold of one, because you're in a community, its influence will then spread very easily to others and others, and that's why each person has to be kept in a forward movement position as far as possible. There's always going to be periods of time when someone becomes influenced. But then the community of devotees not get on their case or overreact, but help that person come again to the forward moving position, because if it's not happening that we're moving forward, complacency will prevail. So when the other side is when there is a pervading mood of moving forward, then that sense of complacency just is dissipated. It's like, you know, the this time of the year, the fog that's there in the morning in Delhi. I think I described, no. Wasn't, maybe I described that here. But wasn't this visit, previous visit, but one morning I had a flight from Delhi and all the flights were delayed because it was, the whole field was just fog. And then at a certain time, I don't know what happened, the clouds opened and some light came through and it was like, the fog was gone, just like that. It wasn't gradual, it was just poof. So, complacency can also be dissipated like that. The modes of nature don't have to grab hold, but one has to actually connect with Krishna. Like, it's like this very, very similar to the example of shadow and reflection. When there's direct sunlight, there's no shadow, there's no reflection. There's no fog. Just poof, it's gone. So the antidote for complacency is abhyasa yuktena. Perseverance in practice. Perseverance to strive forward and apply. So you have mechanisms for that, but I've seen where those mechanisms become lifeless. It's just the schedule is followed and the structure is adhered to, and gee, aren't we doing very nicely? And look, there isn't life. It's again a little bit like Akshay's question of hearing, but then the application part. An application isn't a mechanical application. Mechanical application isn't going to take you anywhere. Not substantially, anyway. So like the morning class yesterday, now we're at the cure stage, applying oneself vigorously in sadhana and applying oneself conscientiously in your academic and other responsible duties of life. But where's the impetus for those things? So within the holy name alone is enough, actually. But we're conditioned souls, so we require this descending mercy coming. And therefore a very strong sense of being connected with that conduit of descending mercy from Krishna that empowers and enlivens both. And your question was perhaps somewhere along the line, how to most effectively demonstrate our the application part. And I the answer I gave was building the community, because that covers all ground. That's a big responsibility, building a community. It's not a lazy man's task, because it goes into all features of life. The schedule, the cooking, relationships, academics, husband-wife dealings, new people, more experienced, you know, just keeping everything in a harmonious, forward-moving position, which the material energy definitely opposes. So it requires a lot of attention, and requires a lot of combined effort, which in Kali Yuga is pretty hard to come by. But that's what's required. Now back to what I first said, everything comes back to the holy name. That's our primary access to Krishna. Immediately he makes himself accessible. Immediately, just through chanting his holy name. So how we do that each day in kirtan, and how we do that each day in performing our individual japa, that's the most important factor. We want to advance in Krishna consciousness is in applying ourselves properly in that activity. It's 9:15. Yeah.
Can you give some tests to measure our quality of chanting? How can we measure the quality of my chanting?
Well, the most basic and simple one is attentiveness. Another is prayerfulness, or mood of calling independence, like Prabhupada's, like a child calling for the mother. Not mechanical, but with feeling. And what feeling? Feeling of dependence. Oh, holy name, please uplift me. Please bring me to that spiritual position. That feeling of reaching out and up to the holy name, taking shelter of the holy name. And I said attentiveness, so perhaps something that's very, very closely connected to attentiveness is effort. It's a brahminical measure, it's not a sonogram, it's something that measures sound. It's not just a mechanical volume, but it's an internal intensity of effort. Then you can say on the negative side, where the mind doesn't wander. But of course the mind wanders, but there are degrees of wandering, and then aside from mind wandering, the alertness that we have to bring the mind back when it does wander, because that's the function of the other one, effort for attentiveness. And that's also a factor of faith, and that is, if I have faith. I have faith that whatever subjects the mind may wander off to, those contemplations, while I'm not making the syllables of the Maha Mantra, but my attention is somewhere else, those things will be far more effectively accomplished in Krishna consciousness if I keep my mind on the holy name rather than processing that other thought while I'm chanting. I'll make a Krishna conscious conclusion not only in that particular subject matter that my mind has wandered off to, but all things throughout the course of my day and throughout the course of my life. My life will be a Krishna conscious example instead of an absent-minded example of being here physically but mentally being some other place, like I am with my chanting, if I'm doing that other thing. So that's faith. We can measure our faith, hold our performance up to the light of one who has faith. That example, there is nothing else in all the three worlds but the holy name. That realization is a realization of one who has lots of faith, and of course lots of practice. End here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.